Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us are retired United States Army General Carter Hamm, the president and CEO of the Association of the United States Army, that just conducted its first virtual annual meeting, AUSA Now, and Andrew Hunter of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who served as a Pentagon acquisition official in the Rapid Equipping Force office. Our coverage of AUSA Now is sponsored by Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS. General Hamm and Andrew, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Vago.
Great to be with you, Vago.
A pleasure. General Hamm, congratulations. As we tape this, there's still some more of AUSA ongoing, but it really was very, very successful from what I could see. So congratulations.
Well, thanks very much, Vago. As we headed into this, we weren't quite sure what to expect because it was our first online virtual annual meeting. But I got to tell you, I think the outcome exceeded my expectations in just about every regard. It was a good event, all in all.
It was extremely well supported by Army leadership. It was great to have as many direct interactions and media roundtables with senior Army leaders, and that's always a pleasure. And the Secretary and the Chief also were very accommodating, as was the Sergeant Major. So that was great. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage, and Beretta USA is sponsoring our coverage of land warfare. General Hamm, you were kind enough to join us last week. You're joining us again this week. What were some of the key takeaways from this year's meeting? Right, each AUSA is an opportunity for the Army leadership to sort of set the messages for the coming year. What were some messages that you heard?
Well, I think, first of all, beginning with the theme for this year's meeting of the time is now, selected by the Army leadership to, I think, convey a sense of urgency for many of the programs and initiatives and the priorities that the Army senior leadership is focused on. I would say for the past couple of days, there were three main topics that really resonated with me, Vago. That was first, the emphasis from the chief, from Secretary McCarthy, from the Sergeant Major of the Army, on people first. General McConville made it clear that people first, that is the number one priority for the Army. And that was emphasized throughout the conversations of the week, beginning with the remarks by Secretary McCarthy at the opening ceremony, where he took on, frankly, some difficult issues, but important issues, the issues of suicide. He took on directly the murder of Specialist Vanessa Guillen by a fellow soldier. He talked about race and inclusion. Difficult topics, to be sure, but important for the Secretary and the senior leaders to talk about. Sergeant Major of the Army talked about this is my squad and the emphasis of getting to know your soldiers' stories. So lots and lots of emphasis on people, to include by AUSA in our presentation of our highest award, the George C. Marshall Medal, to the Army family. So people first would be my first takeaway. Second was the emphasis on project convergence, a new idea, a new phrase to many of our participants who hadn't heard much about project convergence. So the Secretary, the Chief, Dr. Jetty, and others spent some time talking about that. And it really, in its simplest sense, is bringing together capabilities through information age concepts, leveraging artificial intelligence, speed, precision, and not just in warfighting, but in other matters of Army business matters as well. So project convergence, I would say, would be number two. And thirdly, the emphasis, the discussion about the resource challenges that lay ahead. I think the Army, there seems to be a general consensus that a flat defense spending line is about the most optimistic that one can expect in the coming years. The Army has a very aggressive modernization initiative and plan to execute There are proposals for the Army. The Army would like to grow and strength. All of that takes money. In a resource-challenged environment, it is pretty tough. Two things I would say were of note. One is the consistency of Army priorities with this secretary, this chief, dating back to when they were undersecretary and vice chief. That actually has been pretty helpful. The Army has not always been consistent over many years in its modernization priorities. So that's been good. But secondly, the secretary took on directly the issue of divestiture of some legacy platforms, recognizing that that will be very difficult because of constituencies in the Congress, but it will be necessary for the Army to divest legacy systems in order to resource the modernization effort that will be required. So I'd highlight those as three big takeaways for me.
Andrew, one of the messages, and as we heard from General Hamm, and certainly, you know, that the sense of urgency was there from Army leadership. We talked to General McConville, the chief, who said, look, this transformation effort that he and Secretary McCarthy have launched, his time window is sort of 2 years to drive this sort of tectonic change. One of the questions that have been on your mind also was how the myriad of prototype efforts that are now underway will coalesce into major programs of record, something that we talked to Dr. Jetty about in an interview we're going to have out next week. What stood out in your mind after listening to a couple of days of these presentations from senior leadership, as well as pitches from industry? Because the structure of the show was such that you could actually get presentations from industry.
Yeah, well, and very well done, by the way, General Hamm, in putting on such a large and complex undertaking in a virtual format. I've been involved in virtual conferences myself, and they're hard to do, and this was the biggest I think I've ever seen, maybe the biggest virtual conference ever held. Good work. Very interesting and enjoyable experience. I think the Army's urgency or sense of urgency here is really well placed, because if you read the National Defense Strategy, we need to prepare for something that we aren't prepared for, which is a real, true peer competition engagement. And we don't have a lot of time necessarily to prepare. Hopefully we'll have, hopefully it won't happen and we'll have all the time, but we can't count on that. We need to be ready to go sooner. I found the 2-year timeline particularly interesting because it's a bit of a benchmark in my mind when you get into the acquisition world, because it's inside, the budget cycle. Typically when you want to do something new, the first thing you do is you try to put a wedge into the palm. To do it. And typically it's 2 years out before that money actually shows up in your hands to do something. So trying to work inside a 2-year loop is really confronting head on the fact that we have to be more flexible on the way we approach funding, the way we do our funding, the way we budget, in order to drive real rapid change into our systems, into our operations, into our approach to warfighting. So, in that sense, I think they're tackling the hardest challenge head on and directly, which is a very Army approach, one that I appreciate. And I think that really stood out. Obviously, a lot of the discussion about Project Convergence, and which to me is very reminiscent of the great work that the Army did in doing large scale experimentation with its network systems. And they really pioneered that and got, a lot of good utility out of that. And now expanding that basically across the Army into all of these modernization programs to see what can be brought to the game and put it in the hands of users. And I think that's really one of the critical lessons from rapid acquisition was the incredible importance of having user feedback on these systems as they're in development, not waiting until you've passed operational tests and you've kind of locked everything in for 30 years to get that first real user feedback into the development loop. So I think there's a lot of promise there and to see how these systems work together, which is also something we don't do early in the acquisition process, but that we need to.
General Hamm, 2 years is a very ambitious goal. As Andrew said, the key is always trying to do it within a budget cycle. And I have to give the chief and the secretary credit that as the under and as the vice, they were working these transformation efforts along with Dr. Esper and General Milley when they were secretary and chief, respectively. How does the Army achieve this in 2 years? Is it doable?
Well, I think the secretary and the chief would say, it has to be doable in order to address the matters that Andrew just talked about. That speed is important. And so speed of process, I think, is important. And the Army has demonstrated, I think, over the past couple of years that they are willing to make the hard choices when it comes to resourcing and to reduce funding and sometimes eliminate programs that are not of the highest priority in order to resource and place the leadership emphasis necessary on the highest priority requirements. So I think that's promising. And again, the consistency of priorities has been important. The challenge, of course, is, you know, as is always the case with budgets, you know, the Congress changes, you know, this is an election year, you know, what happens to defense spending, the fact that we're under yet again another continuing resolution, there's not yet a National Defense Authorization Act, all of those things impede the Army's ability to turn as quickly as they need to in order to execute the modernization program. So there are certainly some big hurdles to accomplishing the requirements of this two-year timeline. The Army's got a path, but it does require cooperation and support and collaboration with the other instruments of government.
Let me ask about the Rapid Equipping Force, Andrew. I can't let you go before asking you that. As somebody who worked in that office, General Hamm, you benefited from the capabilities the office spun out. The Army leadership's approach has been disbanding that and other sort of rapid equipping efforts by saying, look, we're subsuming this kind of a fundamental approach, right? Dr. Jetty has been talking about this for years, to try to get those cycles out of the acquisition system proper, as opposed to being able to sort of band-aid it with an external capability. Really quickly from the both of you, is this a good idea or a bad idea? Andrew, I suspect I know what your answer is, by the way.
Well, I think the mission of the Rapid Equipping Force continues. So I'm always of a mind that we can come up with different, you know, bureaucratic paths to get to the same solution. And so I don't feel, you know, heartily about the name of the organization or necessarily about the specifics of its structure, although, you know, it has evolved over time to be what it is and has found, you know, as water finds the path of least resistance, you know, it's kind of found its path. And so I think we shouldn't idly dismiss that it's probably one of the better ways to organize the way that the Rapid Equipping Force was set up. But to me, the key point is that the mission continues. You know, you're going to need to have an organization that focuses on rapid response, on adaptability to emerging threats, on providing urgent operational responses to urgent operational needs to warfighters, because we're going to remain engaged. To me, that's the key. And I am concerned with some of what I've heard that, you know, there's a vision that, you know, we're just going to make, everyone's going to do rapid. And so we don't need a dedicated organization. I think that's a step too far.
General Hamm.
Yeah, I would agree with Andrew. The issue is less about the organizational structure and more about accomplishing the requirement. So long as there is a mechanism for soldiers in operational units to make their needs known, for the Army to address those very quickly and get needed material and capabilities very quickly into the hands of operational units. I don't really care much about what the name of the organization is that does that, but I care a lot that it gets done.
General Hamm, one last question. Army and AUSA is all about lessons learned and doing it better the next time. Any sort of hot wash immediate lessons from how the last couple of days went in terms of doing it better next time, as well as you guys did it, right? Everything can be improved.
When we spoke earlier, Vago, I told you we were kind of hoping for, you know, 10 or 12,000 registrants. We had over 20,000, so we're very happy with that. We did encounter a few technical issues, as you always do in something of this scale, so we'll work through those. The real challenge for us going ahead, I think, will be how do we combine the very best of in-person events, because we don't ever want to walk away from those. We want to return to in-person events when conditions permit. But how do we combine the best of in-person with the very best of virtual events that allow us to extend our reach and connect with those who are not able to participate in person? That, to me, is the biggest challenge for AUSA in our event planning for the future.
Well, sir, it was a great event. Can't wait next year to do it in person at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center, so that the AUSA family, as you so artfully put it, convenes again. Thanks very much. Looking forward to the programming today, and looking forward to having you back on again soon. Andrew, thank you so much for all your time, and look forward to welcoming you back again soon as well. All the best to the both of you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks,
Fargo.
And we're back with our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us today are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners, an independent Washington research firm, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many other hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Welcome all.
Thank you, Vago, for having me.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you.
So, Michael, how dead is the stimulus package? How alive is the stimulus package? Where are we? Because this is sort of almost whiplash inducing, right? I mean, the president coming out, as we discussed last week, negotiations were dead. Mnuchin said there might not be a deal. The president is pressing for a bigger deal. Republicans don't want to do the bigger deal. Where on earth are we? Because honestly, this is starting to become beyond childish at this point.
Beyond childish and beyond crazy. Just when you think you can't get any more crazy, it gets crazy each week. So, it's funny. Last night during the president's town hall, he was asked about the relief package. And he said last night, I'm negotiating against Nancy Pelosi. But that's really not true. In fact, today, October 16th, 2020, marks the one-year anniversary since the last time Pelosi and Trump have had a one-on-one conversation. So it's really Mnuchin that's doing this negotiating, and to a lesser degree, Mark Meadows. The parties are really on many different pages. I mean, just a quick recap. I mean, the Democrats passed a $3.4 trillion relief package back on May 15th, and then passed a $2.2 trillion package on October 1st. But the Republican position has been all over the map. So back in June and even into July, they were taking a wait-and-see approach and didn't think anything was needed. Then on July 21st, the Senate Republicans proposed a $1 trillion package. On August 28th, the president upped the ante to $1.3 trillion. On September 10th, the Senate Republicans came back and cut it down to $500 billion. Then on September 30th, the president upped the ante to over $1.6 trillion. On October 6th in the morning, the president said nothing is needed and he was cutting off negotiations. But then by the evening of October 6th, they wanted a package that included more money for the PPP, airline relief, and stimulus checks. On October 9th, the president then came back saying he wants to go big and up the ante to $1.8 trillion. Then on October 12th, earlier this week, the Senate telegraphed that they're going to go down as low as $500 billion. And then the president, the next day, tweeted, go big or go home. So we're nowhere closer to a deal on a relief package, despite the continued discussions between Pelosi and Mnuchin. And, despite the president's continuing to, try and use up whatever limited political capital he's got left with the Republicans. And the Senate Republicans, have been trashing the idea of a larger package. Even going back to last weekend during the conference call among the Senate Republicans, they were trashing this idea. And Pelosi sent two letters to her conference last week expressing disappointment with the progress. And there seems to be a major disconnect, as I mentioned, between the president and congressional Republicans. On Tuesday, Trump urged them to go big or go home on the stimulus package. Yet the Senate Republicans not only trashed that idea of an extended relief negotiated by Pelosi, but now they want to go narrow with a $500 billion package. And McConnell said on Tuesday that the Senate will vote on their $500 billion standalone bill next week that includes money for expanded unemployment insurance, small business, schools, and hospitals. But the Democrats in the Senate have already put up a united front against what they call that piecemeal approach, saying it's insufficient. So yesterday, Pelosi and Mnuchin had a 90-minute conversation, which they say was productive. However, at the same time, lawmakers and staff on the Hill are acknowledging that drafting and passing a $1 trillion-plus bill in the next 18 days is all but impossible. And Mnuchin even said on Wednesday that at this point, getting something done before the election will be very difficult. In addition, the opposition from the Senate Republicans yesterday emerged as a very, very serious obstacle. McConnell said that the president, is willing to go higher than my members are. And McConnell even said that he didn't even think that Pelosi and Mnuchin would even reach a deal. But regardless, the leader ruled out putting a vote on the floor on a large-scale bill. He said, that's not what I'm going to put on the floor. And to make matters worse, Trump's approach continues to be very erratic. And it makes it uncertain whether he can exert the political pressure to move Senate Republicans to take a vote that many of them just don't want to take, especially at a moment when the president is down in the polls and some Republicans are starting to distance themselves from him. Yesterday, Trump called for even more stimulus spending than the $1.8 trillion that Mnuchin has offered. But then at his rally in North Carolina, he didn't even mention the stimulus package. Trump called into Fox Business early yesterday and actually criticized Mnuchin and announced that he wanted more spending that was on the table and said Mnuchin has been unable to bring home the bacon. Around the same time, McConnell's holding a press conference and he's denouncing the larger spending package. Trump seemed to be completely unaware and said the Republicans are willing to do it, and then insisted that Pelosi is standing in the way and accused her of having a lot of mental problems. So Pelosi knows she's got the upper hand right now. She had a private call with her members yesterday, and she told them, look, we have maximum leverage right now. You know, the president even said this morning he wants more. He said the night before, go big or go home. So she's saying this is not the time for us to fold. And to make matters even more bizarre, when the president was on Fox Business and defending his call for more spending, he repeatedly asserted that China was going to pay the nearly $2 trillion stimulus package. And he said, I want to see more money because it comes back. We're going to take it from China. I'll tell you right now, it's coming out of China. So it seems even more bizarre, and time continues to run out. I'll say exactly what I said last week. I think the chances of a relief package before election are really dim and near impossible.
Mackenzie, which is outrageous. China, you can call it the Wuhan flu all you want. Could the Chinese have handled it better? Yes, they didn't do this as a deliberate thing. It's spread. I mean, I think one of the last smallpox breakouts, you know, came from England of all places, right? You know, we've had outbreaks and they did report it relatively early in the process. I mean, it's clear the White House believes in herd immunity, which is one of the reasons it's not doing anything. Unfortunately, the biggest toll it's taking is now in Republican areas that are certainly not going to help the president get votes. You know, even if, you know, Lindsey Graham is doing better in a New York Times poll or any of that. Mackenzie, what are the defense and aerospace implications for this package not going through?
Well, that was a great summary by Michael, which I appreciate. There are continuing implications for defense, not to mention the political pressure of the IG investigation based on the Washington Post story, which Adam Smith has called totally inaccurate, and which he's right. But it puts pressure on the department to prop up the industrial base using its own money. So basically taking it out of Hyde. They're already doing that for a number of other priorities right now, and it's going to eventually, you know, hit things like other milestones and programs. They're going to start taking reprogramming money and other authorities, and eventually they're going to affect the schedules of other programs that they need to keep on track.
Byron, industrial base impacts, looking at it from a Wall Street perspective?
Well, we're on the verge of earnings reporting season. No contractor has really signaled that this is going to be an issue right now. I think they can accrue these costs and expenses. They're an allowable cost. They should be reimbursed at some point in time. But I think to Mackenzie's point, you know, at the end of the day, as we're now in a new fiscal year, the Department of Defense is going to have to start doing some juggling, you know, to fill some of these buckets that have been impacted by an outflow of pandemic related money. So I don't think this will be a big issue in the actual financial results are reported for the quarter, but it really should be a question that investors are asking management. So how is this going to impact your outlook for the fourth quarter and into 2021?
Dove, your former deputy is now the deputy defense secretary, Dave Norquist. I know that very few, you know, he is a comptroller in the finest tradition. That includes you, that includes Bob Hale and Mike McCord and many others over the decades. Bill Lynn, going back a fair ways as well. How do you think the department's going to be handling this?
Well, I think one of the problems is that Dave isn't sitting in the comptroller's seat right now. He's got a lot of other things on his plate. Strictly speaking, it could move monies around. Mackenzie already mentioned the reprogramming. The omnibus went up to the Hill. The Hill didn't fund the whole omnibus, which is interesting, but it funded a good part of it. So monies are being moved around. The problem is you don't have a Bob Hale, or you didn't mention John Hamry, who was a terrific comptroller. You don't have somebody like that, or a Dave Norquist, who understands where the unobligated balances are, where the money can be moved, how the timing works. Right now, you don't, you know, Elaine McCusker's gone. And so you've really got a serious problem, because I just don't think the bureaucracy, they're good people, but they're not the kinds of people who are going to make these really significant and radical decisions in order to keep the ship afloat. That, I think, is the fundamental problem here.
Bongo, let me add just one element keying off of what Dove just said about the availability of the right personnel in the right places. In my judgment, this is actually, in a not terrifically beautiful universe, about the strongest place that DOD could be to try to juggle. We're in a new fiscal year. Resources are available. Flexibilities on the more flexible accounts can push stuff to the right and later into the fiscal year. It is the moment when having a key personnel on hand, like a Dave Norquist at Comptroller, could actually manage this internally in the Pentagon without batting an eye. So I want to reinforce Dove's point. Having the right people to do this is going to be critical. Dave may have to step back in and do his old job.
Before we move on to Navy news and Byron's inside force note, which was fascinating, very quickly, Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State and presidential candidate and former senator and former first lady, a lot of formers in the title, wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs where I think she was trying to be helpful about how to look at defense investment in the future. Gordon, start us off. Was this helpful at all?
No, not particularly, I think. I mean, it's a fairly standard catalog of a sort of, Senate Armed Services Committee former member. It seems to me pretty apparent with the detail on the piece, like talking about the F-35 and details on the nuclear program, that Hillary Clinton didn't write the piece. Curious to know who did. I was curious to begin with why Hillary Clinton thought it was important for her to write a piece for Foreign Affairs on defense planning, unless she's shooting to be defense secretary, which I doubt. It's just a nice little useful, more liberally inclined memoir about what might be done with a defense budget and defense planning that relates domestic and international affairs, that talks about a smarter defense budget, that talks about how to confront China, worries about the F-35, integrating modernization and domestic renewal, and above all, working towards the demilitarization of U.S. national security policy, which is something that she worked on when she was Secretary of State. So it's a nice memoir from Hillary Clinton, but I don't think it weighs in particularly in the politics of the moment, or arguably in terms of future defense planning on Biden administration.
Mackenzie?
So I was just fascinated by it because it's weirdly detailed in its defense cuts. It's like a cafeteria menu of ideas. And, she calls aircraft carriers obsolete. She wants to significantly reduce the Joint Strike Fighter program. But she goes after, some big targets like active duty Army end strength, armored units, closing the Army tank plant in Ohio, ground-based nuclear missiles, And so to Gordon's point, I agree it's a memoir of sorts, but at the same time, I do see some coalescing on the left of that these are the targets for cuts in a potential Biden administration. She does make the case for some new investments under a smaller defense top line, but it is significantly smaller. $70 billion per year is what she's calling for in defense funding cuts. But then she, endorses the B-21 radar, for example, and says, we need more of those in certain submarines. So I actually think it might be somewhat reflective of a larger thinking on the left, but, it's certainly not uniform by any means. It's not a consensus, but the same types of people are picking the same types of programs for cuts. And I think that's a thing to watch.
I have to say, in terms of talking to some of the folks who are closer to the Biden team, I find the importance of the triad come up. I'm just not seeing some of that kind of thinking, or saying aircraft carriers are obsolete. You know, certainly this sense that forces forward in the Pacific are going to be important. I think that's a great segue to go to Byron and his note about the inside force. Obviously, something focused on the Pacific and something each of the services are working on. Byron, talk to us about what the inside force is. And Dove, give us your commentary, because you and Byron have been into a back and forth on our little group as we stay in touch with major issues across the week. Byron, start us off.
Well, it was just a note I put out on Monday. It was a fairly quiet day, and frankly, it was triggered by reading Ian Toll's latest book on the war in the Pacific in 1944-1945. And the inside force really goes back to a concept the Marine Commandant has been talking about really for over the last year now, and it's getting folded into their force design 2030. You saw elements in the Battle Force 2045 plan that was released for the Navy. You know, the fundamental concept here is you would have a force that would be forward deployed and be able to operate in plain sight underneath a complex air and missile defense threat. And, you know, I think, like any big idea, I'm sure people have thought through it, war-gamed it. But when you think about it from a couple of different practical standpoints, you know, is it really going to hold? I mean, is this something that people ought to be building business plans around and thinking through, you know, what are the specific requirements that might drive that? And I read a lot of history. You know, you go back to the Second World War. Okay, you know, the U.S. submarine force was an inside force. That's going to be the case in an Indo-Pacific context. I can't think of a lot of places where there was a garrison that survived in plain sight, maybe the British on Malta. Some of the other conversations that I had with individuals talked about the long-range desert group that moved the SAS forces around North Africa. That was kind of an inside force. It did a lot of damage to the Luftwaffe in the North African campaign. But, you know, you wonder how practical is an inside force going to be, A, with the surveillance capabilities that are going to be available in the next 5 to 10 years, everything ranging from satellites to, frankly, people with smartphones and cameras that are going to be uploading these images of, hey, who are these new guys kind of walking around the Philippines or Indonesia or Malaysia? It's just something that I think we ought to hear a little bit more debate and discussion about to kind of proof, you know, how watertight this concept can be.
Well, that's a little reminiscent to the guy who was up late in Abbottabad, you know, tweeting in real time as the Bin Laden raid was going on. Right. I mean, so in a world where everybody has eyes and ears, it's a lot harder to hide a force. I mean, that was one of the criticisms of the Army's Comanche program was, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how stealthy it is when it flies over, you know, a forward scout, you know, a unit who just hears a helicopter go overhead and they just know that it's not theirs. Dove, give us your sense and some of your thoughts on this as well.
Well, up to a point, I totally agree with Byron. I think it applies especially to land forces other than special forces and or the SAS or the equivalent, who do know how to manage these things in ways that people just can't imagine. I think the real issue is what happens to those eyes, particularly the eyes in space. And here you're getting into all kinds of classified areas because we just don't know what's going to go on up there. If the bad guys are able to see our carriers, we've got a problem no matter where the carriers are. If they can't see the carriers, well, the carriers then have been able to hide themselves in plain sight because the oceans in the Pacific are big. So there's an open question there as to how that would play out. And again, so much of that is beyond the public realm. In terms of land forces, on the other hand, it's just very, very hard to see, as Byron pointed out, how you hide in plain sight with anything other than very, very small special forces units. And I certainly congratulate the commandant for being creative. The question is, does being creative mean being practical?
Yeah, just one comment, which is always behind these sort of tactical and strategic arguments to get plopped out into the public universe. It's always useful, too, I think, to look for where the thinking is coming from. There's a very close link between this kind of concept and the kinds of things the Marine Corps has been invested in for a very long time. Not surprisingly, but if you're in a major war with China and this seems appropriate to the Pacific Operating Theater, you're going to have all these instruments going at the same time, including attempts to get inside the other's force. So it's not a really strategic contact concept. It's an operational, more tactical concept in a framework of a larger arena of combat.
Okay, so let's go to the big week, 245th anniversary of the United States Navy. There are some of us who've always thought it was interesting why AUSA happens to coincide with the Navy's birthday, which is October 13, 1775, now 245 years old. Big news week, Congressional Budget Office had its report commenting on the Constellation class frigate, or it seems like that's what the class's name is now that the lead ship has been named, the new class of heavy frigates for the U.S. Navy. Obviously, Fincantieri Marinette Marine has that contract. The concern was that this contract will not be executed on the cost schedule, the Navy claims. Obviously, Eric Labs, one of the nation's leading minds and something that he always focuses on. We also heard from the Chief of Naval Operations. His first outing pretty sure it was his first outing since his heart episode a couple of weeks ago. Talked about both a fleet that will overmatch while at the same time also introducing his unmanned vision, the Rear Admiral Doug Small, sort of to be the Rickover to drive this new unmanned force. Dove, do you want to start us off as a longtime close advisor to CNOs going back 45 years?
Well, I think this certainly doesn't go back 45 years. And I think what Admiral Gilday has done is certainly commendable. We've got to do it. We basically have to, as he says, exploit artificial intelligence and machine learning in a way that's not just a buzzword, but is actually operational and tactical. So I certainly commend him for that. The only challenge, and it's a major one that I see, is that he actually pointed out that, you know, people like Rickover and Rayburn and Wayne Meyer of Aegis fame were the kinds of people who were able to pretty much drag the Navy into new places in order to have the force meet up with the kinds of challenges of their time. He's named a capable guy, Douglas Small, but what he hasn't done yet is say, okay, you're going to be in charge for 8 years. You're going to be in charge for 6 or 10 years. Because unless you do that and you simply have the usual turnover of commanders, it's nothing's going to happen. It's just the way it is. The Navy, and not just the Navy, the military has had all kinds of initiatives over the years that didn't go very far. I'm thinking, for example, what used to be called remotely piloted vehicles, now called UAVs. For years, they couldn't get anything going. Why? Because they turned over the commanders every couple of years. You got to stay in charge. Rickover was there forever. Meyer was there forever. It makes a difference.
Byron, your thoughts on this as a student of history and driving change?
The number one issue, and Admiral Gilday mentioned this, was at least on Battle Force 2045, the plan's predicated on getting 2% base budget growth and then another 2% or so, 2.1% for inflation. You're back to a starting point where you put this new plan out and already, you know, there'd be underlying questions about, well, what's gonna get played out here, both within the plan and how the plan will compete with other resources in the Department of Defense. So I would agree with Dove's observations. You know, having someone in charge of trying to drive change is good, but at the end of the day, it's going to be a fight for resources. And to me, announcing, kind of a 4% steady state annual budget growth isn't a good place to kind of pivot from.
Especially when there is this overwhelming sense that no matter what happens in November, Mark Esper is not going to be the defense secretary. Mackenzie, let me bring you into this. And Michael, thanks for being patient. I'm going to bring you into the conversation here in a moment. Mackenzie, talk to us about what your sense is about this spending plan at the end of the day and your concerns with it, right? The Secretary Esper is driving forward this notion. What's your sort of sense on what you both heard from the CNO and what that budgeting picture is going to look like going forward?
Yes, and the Secretary spoke on this week at the Heritage Foundation, actually, again, calling for defense top lines that grow each year above inflation by at least 3%. He's sticking to the 3-5% growth. And so that really means 5-7%, right? If you use a 2.1% inflation assumption. So even if it's unlikely, and I agree with Byron, his job is to continue to make the case and to continue to ask for it. And then behind closed doors, build alliances in the White House and OMB and wherever is needed to get that money. Now, right, if he leaves, also very, very likely, he's laying the case for his successor to, continue this crusade or not. I will tell you, OMB is actively supporting Secretary Esper Battle Force 2045. They are seeking money and trade-offs right now for the Navy from other places and sources in the defense budget beyond the Army, although I know that's, the obvious choice and the largest target. And even Secretary McCarthy said this week, Army Secretary, look, we are planning ahead for divestments. We are already looking at cuts for the 23 budget that we know are going to come. He even said readiness is a possibility, which is a kind of a no-no right now, since this administration has spent 3.5 years and a lot of money to build back readiness that had been cut because of the Budget Control Act and other reasons. So it is just going to be a question of, right, what happens in January with a new team? Do they support this? I think the Navy's going to grow either way. I don't know that 500 will live much past a 500 ship fleet will live much longer than Secretary Esper's in the job, but potentially.
Michael, let me bring you into this. I mean, what is the political support? I mean, is anybody on the Hill backing up Dr. Esper in his somewhat rosier budget assessment?
Sure. I think there's, I talked to a member just yesterday who thinks we need to go back to 14 carriers. Not that that's what Esper is proposing, but he's obviously, very supportive of a very large and robust Navy to project power all over the world. But I think Mackenzie's point is very well taken. I think even the Democrats and Republicans are really waiting to see who's in charge next year. And I think, you've mentioned appropriately on previous podcasts that I think that the Republicans will rediscover their fiscal conservatism. And I think that the strains on the Hill will come from both the right and the left on the defense budget next year. And Esper's really got to make these pitches, because in order to support the national defense strategy, the budget has to increase at 3-5% a year, adjusted for inflation, which I just don't see in the realm of reality. And I haven't talked to anybody on Capitol Hill who sees that in the realm of reality going forward.
Let me ask one brief question. We were going all around on the Hillary Clinton note, and I wanted to ask you that because I think you talk to more members than any of us on this call do. Does the case she made have traction?
None at all.
Up on the Hill? Even on the Democratic side?
No, none. Now, I don't want to get into some of the specific things she mentioned because it impacts some of my clients, but politically, many of the things that she suggested are absolutely impossible, number one. And, look, I'm quoted in one of Dick Morris's books defending Hillary Clinton as a national security expert. So I don't want to counter that, but I think that, unfortunately, I think, her thoughts are not really relevant to what the debate's going to be going forward.
I sense dissent coming on. So, Gordon, why don't you start us off? And I sense you too, Dove. So go right after Gordon.
I think there are things peppered around that article that are, in fact, do have resonance, and not just as some have suggested on the left wing of the Democratic Party. There is resonance within more moderate people, including Adam Smith, to some of the things that are there, which is why it's interesting to know who wrote the piece. But really, this whole discussion comes back to, will there be the money? Will there be more defense money? And will more of the defense money go to the Department of the Navy? Those are both hugely open questions for external purposes and for internal purposes. But if you take just one example, she talks about the whole debate about the future of the nuclear force. And I think that's one of the areas where there's a great deal of resonance inside the Democratic Party, in the House and in the Senate, to take a closer look at the rather ambitious modernization plan that's been laid out for the nuclear strategy of the United States. I think that's going to be very much a subject of debate within the Democratic Party writ larger. And there are people who, on the Republican side, who are going to argue vociferously to have more money. And if Republicans hold the Senate, that argument will be fully played out, I expect, in the next Congress. So, you know, rather than suggest, you know, Hillary has wandered off to the left of the party somewhere, a lot of the things that are in this piece do, in my judgment, have resonance within the Democratic Party in Congress.
I just want to point out that it was Barack Obama and Joe Biden that started the entire nuclear enterprise modernization effort, recognizing that the United States was actually losing the ability to produce nuclear weapons, and that decades and decades of decades of underinvestment had brought us to this rather perilous skills point at the end of the day. Dove, give us your sense, and I have one last follow-up question to ask before we
Yes, part. Gordon is right, but that's not the whole story. It seems to me that there are elements in that Clinton article, and I don't agree with Mike. I don't think she's a defense expert at all, but I do agree that somebody wrote it for her. There are elements there that clearly moderate Democrats could support, no question about it. But taken together, this adds flesh to the bone of those 10% cutters on the extreme Democratic left. In other words, you can't match the article to a 10% cut or to a specific dollar figure. But it does provide something that those who wanted to cut the defense budget significantly did not have, which is a program. And she is providing this program that people like AOC can easily latch on to.
But I'm going to point out, AOC is very far on one end of her party. And there is a very, very small coalition there that I don't think, that if anything, the people who are going to be coming in to the office on the Democratic side, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, are going to be more in the center than on the progressive left of the party. Well, I mean, would that be...
Getting back to what I said earlier about why I think a lot of what she says is going to fall on deaf ears, it's not just what she's saying, because I think some of the things she says in her piece really are unachievable. Doesn't mean that everything in there isn't, but it's not just the message, it's the messenger that matters on the Hill. And I don't think a lot of people are going to be saying, well, this is what Hillary Clinton says that we should do, and that will be what resonates from the article that she wrote.
Two very brief points. Mackenzie, I want to bring you in. Any talk about the Air Force here at the end of the day? Because everybody's talking about expanding the Navy, but the Air Force has an extremely compelling case to make about its ability to deliver global power at range with precision and at mass. And there are some air power enthusiasts who are looking at this and scratching their heads and saying, well, wait a minute, why isn't there sort of a greater sense that air power needs to be invested in as well?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. So this week, former Air Force General Dave Deptula, who runs the Mitchell Institute at AFA, came out with an explosive comment that has sent NATO-less into a tailspin, so to speak. Wrong analogy. He said the B-2 bomber has more firepower than an aircraft carrier. And now there's just this raging debate among the two groups. You know, why the comparison? Why would you say that? Is it accurate? Is it true? You know, there will be multiple press reports on this next week following up. But the point is that air power advocates are increasingly nervous, like Army leaders, that, you know, the Navy, that this call for more Navy funding and a greater share of the defense budget, this predates this CNO and this secretary, right? So although they've certainly been calling for it, but Congress has been supportive of this by establishing a sea-based deterrence fund in the past, which fences off money essentially for the Navy, and it can come from other sources. So the Air Force is definitely worried, and they're trying to make their case. There's also some duplication, and senior leaders are talking about and long-range fires capabilities, and how much does the Army and, you know, Air Force need, and what should each service be doing distinctly? And these are some big policy debates that are going to play out very early on for the next leadership team at the Defense Department.
And we're going to have Dave Deptula and Brian McGrath on to discuss the point.
There's another element to this, and that is you've got the Space Force, which is part of the Air Force, and that is going to demand more money with the passage of time. And that, too, is I think, something that the Air Force, I suspect, or elements of it, are going to play up. Clearly, if we're serious about space, we're going to have to spend more money.
I was just going to tag on to this. I mean, I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, I just think this is a debate that's going to be played out in steroids in 2021 and beyond. And none of this is really new in a lot of ways. I mean, how long have we been having arguments about, you know, back to the 1920s about air power versus naval power? So it's kind of, you know, what's the old saying? New wine in old bottles, or did I get that correct? Old wine in new bottles. It's just, I'm not surprised by any of this. I think it also gets back to the point, and I think this is something that Dove and McKenzie and Gordon know far better than I do, but I assume we're going to have another debate about how you can find efficiencies and cost savings in the Department of Defense so that you have to avoid making some of these big platform-centric force structure cuts. And I think that's really the other telling part of this debate, that as much as people may wave a wand and think that's, oh, that's very simple. I think it was Mark Cassian at CSIS who nominated that for one of the worst ideas in national security, I don't know, in 2017 or 2018, that there were all these easy Pentagon savings to be had that you could fund these modernization programs. So
I think Byron's right. It's a lot harder than people think. It's been tried over and over again. And as I think I mentioned earlier, you're going to find some money, but not the kind of money that people imagine they can find.
Until the Defense Department has a willing partner in Congress to let them do what will really get at big dollars, then these efforts are just really fruitless for the department. And the criticism will keep coming, but it's not really their fault. I put most of the blame on their inability to get at some of these larger issues back on Capitol Hill and the other branch. I mean, Secretary Esper, he's talked about DHP. He wants to get DOD out of, you know, education and healthcare as a core business function of the department, which I totally agree with. And, you know, the president tweets and kills, you know, a very modest couple hundred million dollar cut per year to some defense health investments. And that just shows you the bands of which they're the handcuffs that the department's operating under.
Byron, let me ask you one last quick question. On the CBO question on the new frigates, from Fincantieri Marinette Marine standpoint, they're doing exactly what the customer asked. They bid the program, you know, in order to be able to build those ships at cost. I think Eric's point is on each one of these systems, we see cost increases because there are changes in design. You know, from your standpoint, having looked at that report, what do you make of it?
Well, CBO has had its own methodology. I do think there are some differences in this program. You know, it's an in-service ship. It's already been designed. You know, there are going to be some tricks in building it in a place that hasn't built a combatant of this size before. And how are you going to integrate some of the U.S. systems on it? But I can't really pick apart all of Eric's analysis. But I think just kind of taking a flat line, here's the price per pound for a surface combatant and applying that to the Constellation class of frigates. You know, it might be a little, it's a little more nuanced than that.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Terrific conversation as always, and look forward to having all of you guys back next week. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.